Hi, this is Justine Toe, and before we get into this week's Life and Faith episode, I'd like to tell you about a new CPX podcast. It's called The Week at CPX, and it's where we tell you all the stuff that's happening at CPX and sprinkle in some commentary on the side. But why another podcast, we hear you ask? Well, it's a bit of a long story, and here's a short version. Recently, the company that own Facebook and Instagram has had some disagreements with the Australian government over news on social media. Now, while we're not a news organisation per se, much of our content is categorised as such, and according to Meta, we're sort of on the chopping block for groups who are going to be impacted. So if you like CPX and want to keep up with what we're doing, but are a little social media'd out, The Week at CPX is for you. We're going to talk about articles, interviews, upcoming projects, and our views on some current events and other things we're thinking about. Never more than 10 minutes. Never the same stuff each week. Subscribe today so you don't miss an episode. Now, on with Life and Faith.
This week on Life and Faith.
Part of the disease is not biological, but social, in that it's not about what's happening in my brain. It's about how the people around me interact, or more often don't interact with me once I have a dementia diagnosis.
Public life is exhausting. It should be exhausting.
This is where I am. This is where my life is. This is where my relationships are.
There's a tiny little racist person inside each one of us.
And I said, oh, that put me on the spot.
There was just no category for understanding that.
Welcome to Life and Faith from CPX. I'm Simon Smart. The D word, dementia, is one that everyone fears. It seems to strip away everything that made that person experiencing the disease the person we once knew. It's easy to lose sight of the person, the human at the centre of the diagnosis. Today, 420,000 Australians live with dementia. And based on current trends, meaning without some sort of medical breakthrough, that number is projected to double in the next 30 years. And while it isn't an inevitable part of growing older, it's more common among people over 65 years old and is a significant and growing health challenge for Australia's ageing population. Today on Life and Faith, we bring you two conversations that bring the human at the centre of the dementia diagnosis back into focus. We're featuring two interviews that Natasha Moore did before going on maternity leave. First up, Neil Jayasingham, Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Sydney and also a CPX associate. Natasha also spoke to Ben Boland, a chaplain with 15 years' experience in residential aged care. Ben's father also happens to live with dementia. First, here's Ben Boland.
Dementia is a disease. Dementia is terminal. I don't want to sugarcoat that because it shouldn't be sugarcoated. And dementia does much more than simply affect memories. One of the early signs for us as a family that Dad's was struggling with dementia was his ability to get lost. Now, I can get lost every day of the week without any problems at all. I have really terrible sense of direction. But Dad has always had this phenomenal internal compass, internal spatial awareness thing. So for him to be getting lost, that's a really major change. And that's really challenging. So there is real grief, real trauma, real suffering. In terms of how we conceptualize it, remembering truth statements. And that's what we get taught, look in the mirror and say, you're beautiful, you're positive, all those, that positive thinking stuff, there is value in that. And if we say that person with dementia, with the emphasis on the dementia, not the person, then we start to believe our own lies, because that is a lie. These are people who happen to have dementia. So if we can get our focus right on that, it also, having our focus right, helps us to say, oh, well, look, this person's living with dementia, or this person's living with Alzheimer's or Lewy bodies. Oh, I'm going to do some readings to find out how I can better understand what's going on for them, how I can best engage with them, how I can best love them. I think for people living particularly with mild to moderate dementia, knowing that while dementia is terminal, it is not a hopeless space. I am still valuable. I am still important. I am no less important than I was when I was able to work a full-time job and manage three children or whatever my previous experience was. And cognitive behavioral therapy reminds us that knowing the truth and reminding ourselves of the truth can be really powerful internally in terms of people remembering that they are valuable, that they are people. They are not just a disease.
What's it been like for Ben seeing his father live with dementia?
In one sense, it's very strange. I am so used to sitting with people, but sitting with someone as the chaplain is very different to sitting with the person when it's dad.
Why is it so different?
Part of it is length of relationships and depth of relationship. So I will often have family members who are really passionate to communicate with me that the person who's living with dementia was an astrophysicist or something big and valuable. And what they're trying to say is this person's important, and I really hear that. Mm-hmm. But from my perspective, they're Mary or Peter or Fred, and I've met them where they are. And so I don't actually face the losses that they're facing, because I've only known Fred as someone who's nonverbal and who I can smile at and walk down the corridor together. Mm. So it's much easier to meet someone where they are in some ways when you don't have the history, when you're not processing the personal grief, the personal sorrow in that space. So that's significant. And I think that helps sometimes as a chaplain and makes it really hard as a son, trying to work out how do I support mum when her grief is also my grief and my grief is her grief. And caring for someone living with dementia, or caring for someone, full stop, is tough. The big thing, love people, is black and white. What that looks like, that's not black and white. That's complicated. It's messy.
What have you found to be effective in kind of reaching or engaging with, encouraging, caring for people with dementia?
It starts, and indeed, it's largely 95%, is continuing to have a relationship with those people, continuing to visit that person. Now, it may be that you can do that physically. It may be that that person's hours away. And so it's a case of phoning them or WhatsApping or Zooming or Skyping, or we've got some wonderful technology as we're using this afternoon that's possible there. We can do simple things again at a distance. I had one family. So I'm up in Queensland. There was a son down in Melbourne. So he'd organised with the local grocer to provide a fruit box, a box of fruit with a packet of nuts or sweets or something, a treat, to be delivered to his mum every week. That increased her fruit consumption, which is always good, and gave her some more diversity. But it also gave her something to give away, which is actually a way of engaging with people. That's profoundly helpful. So just those sort of things, but simply turning up. And turning up on the basis that we know that these people who are valuable, as opposed to turning up because we want to get something out of it. I remember in one space I was working in, I met a lady in the corridor I didn't recognise, a younger lady, and she said, oh yes, well, mum's just died. I haven't seen her for 2 years because she didn't recognise me anymore. Part of me wanted to say, but so when someone has a baby in your family, do you not go and see the baby because the baby doesn't know you? This is your mum. This is someone who is important. This is someone who may not know your name, but how can we not hold them? People living with dementia, just like people living without dementia, are designed for, created for, relationship. All humans need relationship. Solitary, there's a reason solitary is a form of torture. So we need to be engaging. And that may mean that you have a conversation 50 times. There are some people I visit, when I get 3 words into the story, I know where the story's going to go, but it's important for them to tell the story. There's some real recent neurobiology stuff that they have done to show with hormone levels, the person may turn around and 5 minutes later not know you visited. But hormonally, their body knows and has had an endorphin boost of, I've been visited. I'm more happy. I know some joy. Now, I may not know why I'm feeling joyous. That's okay. But that's really powerful.
We'll hear more from Ben later, but here's Neil Jayasingham, Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Sydney, speaking about what good care looks like for people living with dementia.
What do I think good care looks like? I think good care is about the kind of care that you would give to yourself. And this is really important. A lot of people tell me about, oh, manage this person as though they were your mother or your father. And I can't do that. I would say that if it was my mother or father, I wouldn't try any of these medications. I'd be too terrified to make a decision. But what I would do is I would think that what if I was that 85-year-old with severe dementia? What sort of things would I want in that circumstance? And then I would use whatever necessary in order to try to help things to improve. But I'd still want them to be involved in what's happening. So it does include medication, because a lot of people really think that all medication is a bad thing in aged care. I understand that perspective because my profession, unfortunately, has thrown antipsychotics in people who don't have schizophrenia or people who don't have psychotic conditions. They have the same therapeutic benefit as a blunt hammer in terms of simply knocking out people so that they're easier to feed and to dress, which I am very disappointed at, because there's a huge amount of good that is done with antidepressants, with mood stabilizers, which can improve quality of life, provided that you're prescribing them with the idea that this is what you would be taking if it was yourself. But it's certainly not just medication. It is about a respect for the person's humanity and allowing the possibility of miracles to happen. One of the most significant patients that I remember was a lady with frontal lobe dementia. The frontal lobe is where most of our personality sits. So when that gets damaged, your impulse control, your aggression, your disinhibition, that really gets bad. By way of understanding, that's the bit which you turn off when you drink too much alcohol. So a person with frontal lobe dementia is basically the most affected drunk person you'd ever seen. So this was a patient who I saw who was terrible. She had a colostomy bag put in, and apologies in advance for anyone listening to this while eating. She would paint the walls with her own fecal matter. She was aggressive. She was the hardest person to nurse inside the facility. No one obviously wanted anything to do with her. And she was put on loads of sedating medications with not a whole lot of benefit. We started on a fairly old mood stabilizer, which has quite good evidence for management. And she did seem a lot easier to manage, a lot less aggressive, but she was still quite unwell. There was still no focus to anything that she was doing. Until one day when I saw something unusual, I saw in her room a cross stitch. And it was a remarkably high quality cross stitch. The color definition was surprising. And I was wondering where that came from. And one of the nurses told me that the patient had made it. And apparently they'd had a little art class. The patient had sat in the corner and constructed this herself. And then I thought, there's something really different here. Did she have any sort of art history? And apparently no. There wasn't any history of anything from that. Family said that she'd never done anything like this before. And we had a dedicated art therapist working with her who soon found that she had nothing to do. She was just basically getting the materials and giving them to this patient. And she started to create these beautiful works. So the medication made it possible to actually start talking about this issue. But then that really sealed the deal. Suddenly, all the anger and management difficulties all disappeared. And she spent all day creating these works, which were objectively of surprisingly good quality. Certainly not the person whose painting materials were a little less appropriate just a few weeks ago. And then about a month or so after that, the facility manager held a mini gallery exhibiting all of her works inside an exhibition room, which is just around the foyer. So all the visitors towards the facility came in to find about 30 handmade cross-stitch works hung up and presented there. The patient's family were there as well, and she was there watching everyone observing her works. She was completely nonverbal. She had no language, but She sat there with a smile the entire time, and the family said they had never seen her that happy.
Wow.
2 weeks later, she died. Mm. But just before she died, she lived in a way that she had never lived before.
You're listening to Life and Faith, and while this episode is officially about dementia, it's really about how we best care for people we know and love who are living with the condition. Before the break, you heard Associate Professor Neil Jayasingham introduce a professional or medical perspective on the disease, but as you'll hear him say now, there's still a very relational element at the heart of all of that.
My commonest presentation with dementia is with people being concerned that they may have it, but I've also had a lot to do with managing the behaviors for people who already have established dementia. When I was a psychiatry registrar, I first learned about the process of psychotherapy with psychodynamic psychotherapy, which is essentially about very invested listening and understanding the story of the individual in order to try to work out a meaning to it. And I asked one of my supervisors whether I could do this in a nursing home environment as well, to which she agreed. And I had a patient who I still remember really, really clearly. She was incredibly aggressive, very difficult to engage with, refusing to take any of her medications, shouting, essentially a major management problem. So I tried talking to her, and we met weekly for 6 sessions, for about an hour each session, and they rapidly became half an hour, when I realized how very, very soon she had absolutely no short-term memory and wasn't recalling a single thing that I was saying or that we would actually discuss. So I gave up, and the week after that, I went back into the nursing home to do my usual rounds. And 6 separate members of staff all came to me to say, "Wow, what did you do to her? She's a completely different person.
Wow.
I don't know what you started on her, but it's definitely working." And I was like, we didn't actually put her on anything, but the engagement had greatly improved. She was sleeping better. She wasn't hitting people anymore. She was turning up to her meals. And people kept on coming to me saying that, "Oh, it's amazing." And I went to talk to my supervisor about that. And I said that I was really amazed in this because even in this person with such advanced dementia, simply listening to her and allowing her story to be recognized and recognized by herself, even though I was absolutely certain that it wasn't doing anything, meant that there was a change. And then my supervisor reported me as a serious issue in terms of clinical misconduct. And the issue was that they believed that I had obviously misrepresented how well this patient had gotten. Because no one with dementia possibly gets better from being listened to. So there was a lot of learning experiences in that. I mean, fortunately, I completed my training. and I'm now a psychotherapy supervisor myself, which I say with something between a sense of revenge and malice. But it's a really powerful thing because this patient was really awful to her carers. She was incredibly aggressive. She was very difficult to engage with. The only thing I did with her was listen to her. And the lesson, I suppose, was that people with dementia are still people. They're still in there.
So have you seen those kinds of effects repeated with other patients? Like, was that a bit of an anomaly?
I thought it was an anomaly until I started doing the research. There was a fascinating study with a group of moderate to severe Alzheimer's patients. This team gave everyone 4 sessions of psychotherapy. And they had a whole host of outcome measures which were used to analyze the patients and to study about the progress. And every single one of those outcome measures showed no change, absolutely no benefit, except for one measure, which was the CARA scale. So they had an open-ended questionnaire, which was provided to the carers, as in the family and loved ones of the patients, for people to just write down whatever they said. And almost uniformly, despite all the other outcome measures not showing a whole lot, the families and carers said something had changed. One of the most prominent ones was, "I don't know what you did, but you made my mother better." And it was a very similar experience to what I had. we find it strange, and I think we find it a bit threatening, to think of people with dementia as being people. It is easier to dismiss them. It is easier to pretend that they are a separate group. But there is still something of a humanity inside there. And rediscovering and maintaining that humanity is such an important part of a person's progress.
What do we know, Neil, about religion and spirituality in the context of dementia?
So there has been a lot of research regarding the role of religion in mental health in general. And we know that what has been of a strongest level of evidence is anything which is involving community engagement as well as observation of ritual. But the community engagement is the biggest part. That is the biggest thing that is missing in dementia, which is why religious services make such a big impact in nursing homes. In good residential aged care facilities, there is always an opportunity for religious expression, particularly ones that are connected with others. With regards to Alzheimer's dementia in particular, though, there is very interesting research which looks at this area specifically. And back in 2022, there was an attempt to try to look at all these different studies, because there's a lot that has been published in these. So an integrated review was done in 2022. And what they found was that generally, if you had any measure that was identifying positive religiosity and positive spirituality, that was associated with decreased behavioral and psychological expression and frequency and severity. So what that translates as is, if you had a religious position with a spiritual position, you were less likely to have problematic behaviors in dementia. This is called an integrative review, which means that it's about adding together the evidence from multiple studies. That comes towards level one evidence. And level one evidence is basically as good as it gets. There's no doubt about this issue being the case. It meant that we know for sure that a religious position and a spiritual position is helpful for people with dementia.
Are there specific spiritual practices, things like prayer, music, liturgy, religious services or rituals that you've seen have an effect within the care of people with dementia?
So people have studied prayer, people have studied ritual and observance, and what keeps on coming up is the personal meaning and attachment to them rather than the observation of the ritual itself. And I think that's why the study is so important. They didn't just look at religious identity, they looked at spirituality, which means that it's a level of interest in the things that we cannot see, an interest in the idea that there is more to the world that we can perceive. And those things were associated with benefit at that time. But I do remember very, very strongly, there was a, she was probably, I think, in her late 60s, a Middle Eastern woman once in a mental health unit where I worked at a very long time ago. She had a severe psychotic depression with intense anger and difficulty to engage, where she was preoccupied with the belief that her insides were rotting. So she knew for certain that she was dying and no one could change anything about it. And how dare anyone change anything about that? So that's called a psychotic depression. She was depressed, but she also was believing things that were not based in reality, hence the psychosis. Now, the best treatment that we have for psychotic depression is electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT. So ECT is still quite commonly used. It's actually a lot safer than most of the other treatments. Its risk of dangerous events is less than 1 in 10,000. It's actually safer than going to the dentist. But the problem with electroconvulsive therapy is that there is a small risk of memory damage. We know for sure that it doesn't cause brain damage, but it can disrupt pre-existing memories, which is why we tend to reserve it for severe circumstances. And we thought that we were getting there with this lady, because after suffering for over a month with the antidepressants and the antipsychotics, she was still certain that she was absolutely going to die. Until one day when her pastor came in from the Greek Orthodox Church that she used to visit. And suddenly her face, which was locked in this rictus of anger and it lit up, and she was absolutely enthralled to see him. And I hadn't seen her smile in over a month. He stayed with her for a while. He prayed with her and gave her communion. And then after that, that was when the change happened. We didn't need to go on towards shock therapy. We didn't make any other changes in her medication. Things just changed. She improved from that time. There was something about her religious faith and her identity and her connection with this pastor that was so powerful that really changed her in such a fundamental way. It was amazing to me that in a department which is ostensibly full of people who were caring for her, the person she responded to was the person of her religious background. And that created a change in her that all of us were unable to do for more than a month.
So what do you make of that?
Well, I think it is miraculous. I think it's powerful. I'm glad for what happened with her. It makes me think about what else could be happening out there. It makes me think about all the people who might benefit from a visit from their pastor or the right sort of opportunities to be able to engage with those. I've also seen the obverse. I've seen well-meaning people suggesting you can pray away the depression. And I've also seen people lose their faith as a result of relying on religious practices to treat mental health issues rather than what they're supposed to be there for, which is for the maintenance of identity and courage to continue to change. But it is amazing to me because I watched her change from an angry old lady to the sweetest, kindest person that I'd ever seen. It means that we need to be open to the opportunities that religious interventions can provide. We need to be open to the need to respect that spiritual dimension. We need to acknowledge that we don't have all the answers. There are certainly things that we don't understand that still can change people in fantastic ways.
Chaplain Ben Boland believes that faith can play a significant role in helping people cope with their diagnosis.
I have seen lots and lots of people where it is their real strength. It is their solace. People who make a point of praying, even though they can't read their Bible anymore because they're blind or they can't find their Bible. When I was at Bible college, I used to visit an Orthodox lady. Now, her bed was surrounded by icons, which is not my faith tradition, but she just wanted me to sit and read the Bible with her. And that provided real comfort. The Bible says that people are important. People are created in God's image. And it's not about what we do or even about what we remember, but it's about what God remembers. Mm. And this is a conversation I had with Dad. Well, what happens if I forget God? Well, Dad, is your Christianity about what you'd done or about what God had done? Oh, God. Is your faith continually about what you're doing or about what God is doing? Oh, God. I think God's probably got it then. Oh, that's really good. And I think that's one of the great strengths, if I can use the right phrase, of Christianity. Christianity is not about people being good. It's about having a good God. And so that applies particularly when we're dealing with dementia, with mental health issues. No matter how good or bad we are, Jesus loves us. It's not Ben's a good bloke, Ben's gone to church, Ben's going to heaven.
Both Ben and Neil are sensitive to the fact that this discussion of dementia, or any discussion of sickness or increasing frailty as we age, gets to the heart of what we believe it means to be human.
So different cultures prioritise different things as being more important. And in our modern Western culture, independence, our brain, and choice have become really central to our understanding of being and self, not simply in an identity sense, but in a value sense. That means that you've got people like Peter Singer saying that people, once they hit a certain point with dementia and their cognition slips to a certain magic number, which has never been identified, they cease to be people. So euthanasia is appropriate. But there's a growing body of research that says part of the disease is not biological, but social. It's about how the people around me interact, or more often don't interact with me once I have a dementia diagnosis. Thanks to Descartes, we have this wonderful, I think, therefore I am. But as Swinton has pointed out, so you're not a being when you're asleep, We wouldn't suggest that infants, Natasha, I believe you're about to have one, are less people because they're less able to do a PhD than somebody who's older. Throughout our life, we face change, and through life, our ability to think changes as well. The challenge for someone with dementia is that the changes are faster than perhaps in other contexts. And that can have some really scary things and make it really challenging for the person. And it can be really challenging and scary for their loved ones as well.
There is something more to us than our brains and our bodies. I used to be sure that the brain is ourselves. Now I think that the brain is the means with which we use to express ourselves and to connect with others. And even in incredibly serious decompensation, there is still a person, there is still a soul, there is still something there which identifies who we are. We are more than our emotions. We are more than our memories. We are more than many of our decisions, because many of them are unconscious. It's something beyond physical function. There is something that persists beyond all of those things, that is an integral part of who we are. And it is there even in the worst and most overwhelmed of individuals. It's something that is to do with good and bad. It is something to do with moral decision making. It is something which is there when you sleep, and it's something that is there when you wake up. It's who you are. And the most I can do is to try to jumpstart the failing brains and to try to get them behaving like they were a little bit more like before, whilst I know that I'm dealing with something that is dying and degenerating. But that doesn't mean the human is. There is something about the person that will stay there forever, even after the body passes away.
A final thought from Ben, who leaves us with a taste of how loving relationships can survive a dementia diagnosis.
So I remember caring for one couple, and they were living together in their own home, and I could see very early that progressively his dementia was getting worse and worse. And I remember having a conversation with his wife and saying, oh, look, this is really hard, and do you think you need to be moving him into care, or how's that going to work? And that's a really tough conversation to be having. But her comment has always stuck with me, and that was that I don't want to miss a moment. I've been married to this man for 60-something years, and I don't want to miss a moment or relationship with him. Is he confused? Yeah. Is he struggling? Yeah. But I don't want to miss a moment. And I think that is the model of what our relationship with people living with dementia should be. This is a really important person, and I don't want to miss a moment.
You've been listening to Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart. A big thanks to Natasha Moore for interviewing Neil Jayasingham and Ben Boland before going on leave. You heard Ben refer to Natasha, who was at that point almost ready to give birth. And we're delighted to let you know that in the weeks since, that baby has arrived safely. So, good news to report. If you've enjoyed this episode, why not share it with others who you think would benefit from it? You can also leave us a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. And a big thanks to our producer, Alan Douthwaite. Next week.
In walking the Camino to Santiago, I had a very profound realization. I had done exactly the same thing with my rucksack as I'd done with my life. So I had everything in this rucksack, including a thermos flask and powdered soup in case the weather was cold. I packed a shortwave radio so I could stop and listen to the BBC World Service. Ridiculous, and I was carrying so much weight, I got terrible blisters. And so I started to discard stuff to make the burden lighter.